Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is For the Record program number 449, titled The July Surprise. This is being recorded on March 7th of 2004. Before I begin the program, let me remind you that sister station WFMU is archiving the For the Record programs. More recent programs are streaming at wfmu.org/Dave Emery, one word, D-A-V-E-E-M-O-R-Y, and older programs are available for download only on Real Audio at a longer URL linked to both the wfmu.org/Dave Emery address and to the For the Record section of the Spitfire website at www.spitfirelist.com. Spitfire List, by the way, is one word, SPITFIRELIST.com. In the Spitfire website, in the For the Record section, there will be a detailed, annotated, article-length description of For the Record program number 449 within a week or so of the airing of this program. By the way, I'm very pleased to announce that as of March 7th, there is not only a search engine on the Spitfire website to help people locate information in the descriptions for the For the Record programs, but also, as of last week, the entire text of the book Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile by the late Paul Manning is available on the website as well. Now, the title of this program, The July Surprise, is my hypothetical or my term for an event that I believe took place. I should stress that this broadcast, as is the case with many programs, is to a certain extent interrogatory in nature. What we're going to be looking at is the breakup of the peace talks that were being held at Camp David in the summer of 2000 between former Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak of the Labor Party and Yasser Arafat and the PLO. Those negotiations came to an unsuccessful conclusion, obviously, with what's going on in the Middle East now. Those negotiations came to an unsuccessful conclusion on July 24th of 2000. That same day, Dick Cheney, oil man, former defense secretary, and a close associate of the elder George Bush, was named as George W. Bush's vice presidential running mate. It is my belief that the fact that both of those occurrences took place on the same day, and later on in the program we're going to take a look at the New York Times for July 25th. Lead story was about the breakup of the Camp David negotiations. Number two was about Cheney getting the nod as Bush's running mate. In my opinion, those two events are connected, and two of the things that connect them are elements of the intelligence community, in particular the petroleum industry and Saudi Arabia. I suspect, and again I can't prove this, but I suspect that the negotiations between the Israelis and Ehud Barak and the Labor Party and the Palestinians and Yasser Arafat were deliberately sabotaged by the Republican Petroleum Saudi Intelligence Axis that had held sway during the administrations of Ronald Reagan and the elder George Bush. I will be terming this hypothetical sabotaging of the peace talks the July surprise, since it took place in July. I am convinced that had those negotiations been successful, then Al Gore would have carried the 2000 election, because it would have given the Democrats a tremendous foreign policy feather to stick in their cap, so to speak, and would have resolved, or at least pacified, a major area of turmoil and bloodletting, and one of that whose chaos and violence threatens to engulf the world at this particular point. Time permitting, we will talk about some of the motivations for that beyond, obviously, or for the hypothetical sabotaging beyond obviously the fact that making sure that Clinton did not broker a successful peace negotiation or peace treaty between the Palestinians and the Israelis was a good way to help neutralize the Democratic campaign ammunition, so to speak, for 2000. Again, time permitting, I'll talk more about what I suspect was underlying that in terms of motivation, again, if time permits. What we're going to begin with is some dalliance between the Reagan-Bush campaign and the Palestinians concerning what has come to be known as the October Surprise, namely the apparent collusion between the Reagan-Bush campaign and the Khomeini forces in Iran to withhold the U.S. hostages that had been taken from the United States Embassy in November of 1979 until after the election, assuring Jimmy Carter's humiliation and consequent defeat. The evidence from various sources that just such a deal took place is quite strong. It is discussed, by the way, in the recent book American Dynasty by Kevin Phillips. We're going to reprise, or actually not reprise, but we're going to turn to an article. This is actually an excerpt online from a portion of the Congressional Record and an article from the New York Times by Gary Sick about the October surprise cues, this particular portion of the Congressional Record. What we're going to look at here is Richard Allen, Robert McFarlane, and Lawrence Silberman, currently the co-chair of the commission that's going to be investigating intelligence failures, and indications that, in fact, not only was there collusion between the Reagan-Bush campaign and the Khomeini forces, but that the PLO, and specifically Bassam Abu Sharif, an Arafat aide and spokesman, is in possession of concrete information concerning this approach by the Reagan-Bush campaign. Remember that the vice presidential running mate in this ticket, George Bush, had been director of the CIA, and that the manager of the campaign, William Casey, was not only an old intelligence veteran, but later went on to become head of the CIA and presided over the Central Intelligence Agency when the Iran-Contra affair was underway. That obviously had very obvious collusion between the Khomeini forces in Iran and the U.S. Of the PLO being approached for a role in what basically was treason in preventing the release of the U.S. hostages from the embassy, the Congressional Record and this section of it read, "But while Allen, again Richard Allen, McFarlane, and Silberman were claiming to reject the deal in Washington, their colleagues were scanning the globe for similar openings to Iran. PLO Representative Bassam Abu Sharif, Yasser Arafat's chief spokesman, told journalist Morgan Strong that a Reagan backer had approached PLO headquarters. Quote, "During the first campaign, the Reagan people contacted me," claims Abu Sharif, again quoting, "One of Reagan's closest friends and a major financial contributor to the campaign," he kept referring to him as Ronnie, "he said he wanted the PLO to use its influence to delay the release of the American hostages from the embassy in Tehran until after the election. They asked that I contact Arafat and make the request. We were told that if the hostages were held, the PLO would be given recognition as the legitimate representative of the Palestinian peoples, and the White House door would be open for us," unquote. The PLO was a reasonable choice to serve as hostage broker. 2 weeks before the embassy takeover, Arafat negotiated the release of 13 of the American hostages. If Arafat could persuade Khomeini to release some hostages, he might just as easily persuade him to hold the rest a little longer. The PLO has so far refused to document those charges. Quote, "We have the proof, if it is denied," says Abu Sharif, again quoting, "and they said they would deny it if it ever became public. I hope it does, because I would like to drop the bombshell on them," unquote. Still, we have no corroborating details to confirm Sharif's account. So again, note that a key Arafat spokesman, Bassam Abu Sharif, claims that they have the documentation of this approach made by the Reagan-Bush campaign. One of the hypothetical elements that we're going to investigate during the course of the broadcast concerns the possibility that that potential political blackmail, that potential item of political blackmail, may have been one of the factors that led to the creation of Baker's Dozen, namely a bunch of moderate PLO leaders who specifically were taken to Langley, Virginia, coached in the latest PR techniques by the Central Intelligence Agency, this at the initiative of then-Secretary of State James Baker. Now, of course, James Baker is a very close ally of both George's Bush. His law firm, Baker Botts, is representing, among others, Prince Sultan of Saudi Arabia in the lawsuit that has been filed by survivors of September 11th. Baker Botts is also the main counsel for the Carlyle Group as well. We should remember, as we entertain this hypothesis, that Saudi Arabia has for a long time been the primary financial backer of the PLO. We've talked about this in a number of broadcasts, including FTR 340. Bear in mind that that Saudi link to the PLO is essential. It's also worth remembering that the Saudis despise the Palestinians. The only group they hate more than the Palestinians are the Israelis, and I suspect that in addition to preventing the arrival of a democratic state, a democratic Palestinian state in the Middle East, the Saudis wouldn't be altogether torn up to see the Israelis and the Palestinians wipe each other out. But in order to achieve the realpolitik of Islamist politics, the Saudis have always been very vocal and very munificent backers of the PLO. So remember, the PLO, to a certain extent, financially and diplomatically, something of a cat's paw for Saudi Arabia, and the links between the petroleum industry, Saudi Arabia, the Bush family, and the petroleum faction of the intelligence community could not be exaggerated. We're going to turn now to a remarkable book that we've used many times in the past. It's called The Secret War Against the Jews, subtitled How Western Espionage Betrayed the Jewish People. It's co-authored by former Justice Department investigator John Loftus and Mark Ahrens, published in hardcover and softcover by the St. Martin's Press, and the full details, including ISBN number, will be in the description for the Record program. Now, in evaluating what I have termed the July surprise, bear in mind the PLO connection, according to Abu Sharif, to the October surprise and the potential leverage that would have given the PLO, and evaluate the possibility that that may have been one of the factors leading to the establishment of Baker's Dozen. Baker's Dozen was the nickname given by the CIA to some of the Palestinian leaders who were brought over to be coached by Langley in order to fit them into American foreign policy objectives. Turning now to the secret war against the Jews, according to our sources, the CIA secretly brought several moderate Palestinians to the United States for intensive briefing. This group, codenamed Baker's Dozen, including most of the, quote, official, unquote, Palestinian negotiating team with Israel. That last sentence again. This group, codenamed Baker's Dozen, included most of the official Palestinian negotiating team with Israel. Quote, Hanan Ashrawi, Hana Senora, Saeb Erekat, Sari Nusseibeh, and other lower-ranking Palestinians were summoned to Langley for a three-day conference on integrating their politics with the U.S. Ashrawi was singled out as a good Palestinian image spokeswoman, dubbed by the company, quote, the Palestinian Golda Meir. The point being here that the CIA, at least under Reagan and Bush, was playing a double game. Bear in mind that CIA headquarters is named for the elder George Bush. And note in particular that in 1988, apparently this is when this took place, certainly in the 1980s, the relatively late 80s, the CIA brought some of the more moderate Palestinian leaders, including the official Palestinian negotiating team, to Langley. They were dubbed Baker's Dozen after James Baker. And that this gave basically the Republican and petroleum industry axis a very tangible operational link with the Palestinian side of the negotiations at Camp David. What we're going to look at now is the collusion between the Republican Party during the Clinton administration and the Israeli far right, in particular the Likud Party. Summing up very briefly, throughout Bill Clinton's administration, elements of the Republican right, including Newt Gingrich, were actively subverting his attempts to negotiate a peace in the Middle East. One of the elements of subversion concerned a bill that was introduced. It was called the Dole Amendment, that would have switched the United States Embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. Then Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin, assassinated shortly thereafter, argued against this, arguing that it would retard the peace process. An amendment was, in fact, a bill was passed, but Bill Clinton vetoed that. We're going to take a look at that veto right now. We're going to turn to a book called Dollars for Terror, The United States and Islam. This was authored by Richard LaBeviere, published in softcover by Algora Books, and it is, for my part, the best book yet written about September 11th, and it was published in French in 1999 and in English in 2000, but it's a remarkable book and gives us some excellent insight about September 11th. Turning to Dollars for Terror, indeed, constitutionally, the president can suspend the application of a law approved by Congress if he judges it contrary to the higher interests of the country, as was the case for the Dole Law that proposed to transfer the embassy of the United States to Jerusalem. And again, President Clinton vetoed this particular bill, but it was brokered by the Republicans. Later, Newt Gingrich traveled to Israel and gave an address before the Knesset, the Israeli parliament, that specifically was at odds with administration policy in regard to the Middle East, and specifically opposed the creation of a Palestinian state. Now, bear in mind that as the 2000 talks, as the stage is set for the 2000 talks, you've got the Republican right, the petroleum industry, and via Saudi Arabia with a profound hold on the Palestinian side of the negotiations. Through former U.S. Ambassador to Italy Maxwell Rabb and the Italian far right, including residual fascist elements, there were links between the American right wing and the Israeli right wing, including the Likud party, in precisely this same time period. The following is excerpted from For the Record program 252 from October 8th of 2000. This is Searchlight issue number 304. This is an article entitled, appropriately enough, International Fascist Axis. It's by Searchlight contributor Jerry Gable, actually Searchlight editor Jerry Gable, last name G-A-B-L-E. And note here that in addition to the networking between various Eurofascists and between American reactionaries and former diplomats, there is also an element of networking going on between Eurofascists and members of the extreme right Likud party in Israel. In a number of broadcasts, we've taken a look at fascist elements within the Zionist movement. There is a miscellaneous archive show entitled Fascist-Zionist Connections, also a broadcast entitled Strange Bedfellows, and a previous Before the Record segment about global fascism, which discussed the attendance at the National Conference of the National Alliance of Gianfranco Fini, of Bill Young, a U.S. representative from Florida, a member of the U.S. House of Representatives, a Republican from Florida, and also a member of the Likud Party. Both of them attended the National Conference of the National Alliance in February of 1998 and sent their best wishes. So in addition to networking here between American reactionaries and Eurofascists, we should note here that those same elements are also hooking up with far-right elements in Israel as well. Turning now to this article, again entitled International Fascist Axis by Jerry Gable, from the Searchlight's October 2000 issue number 304, the article reads as follows. As Italy totters on the brink of a snap general election, the right is pulling out all the stops in an effort to gain power. Mirroring the rise of the fascist Jörg Haider in Austrian polls is the revival of Italy's far right and its allies. Reactionary forces from within Vatican circles and former senior members of the old corrupt Christian Democrats have been courting and being courted by Silvio Berlusconi, the convicted right-wing populist multimillionaire, his political partner Gianfranco Fini, leader of the Fascist National Alliance, and Umberto Bossi of the Separatist Northern League, as well as the riffraff groups of old and new fascists, extremists, and anti-Semites currently hanging around Berlusconi in his right-wing broad front, the Pole of Liberty. By the way, in a miscellaneous archive show, we took a look at Silvio Berlusconi, and his role as a member of the P2 Lodge, the fascist P2 Lodge of Licio Gelli. We also recouped some of the connections, so we recapitulated some of the connections between Berlusconi and the P2 in For the Record program number 229, an update on Eurofascism, and that was excerpted from that miscellaneous archive show. More about Berlusconi of the P2 and his growing political fortunes in Italy. Berlusconi is now directing his appeal to the Italian public in almost scattergun fashion, making demands for the protection of the traditional Italian family and its values, whatever they may be, at the same time as pushing soft porn images to appeal to young men, and probably a few older ones, who have been driven towards the right by fear for their own and their nation's virility. At a private breakfast meeting last spring between Berlusconi, Fini, and the former U.S. Ambassador Maxwell Rabb, an old friend of the Italian far right, at a private breakfast meeting last spring between Berlusconi, Fini, and the former U.S. Ambassador Maxwell Rabb, R-A-B-B, an old friend of the Italian far right, a fourth person present was Pier Fernando Cassini, C-A-S-I-N-I. Cassini, a member of the Christian Center Democrats, is known in Italy as the Ayatollah of the Catholic fundamentalist movement. But as well as courting Catholics, the Paul of Liberty is also trying to win friends among right-wing Jews in Israel and New York. The Jewish community in Rome and the new and growing community in Trieste, recently enlarged by Jews leaving Carinthia, the Austrian province under Haider's political control, now fear they may be endangered and isolated by those Israelis who share many of Berlusconi's and Fini's political views. Rab is the key player in these dirty political dealings. Earlier this year, a report circulated that a youth camp for followers for Berlusconi's and Fini's wings, as well as from the Northern League, was attended by an official from the youth movement of Israel's right-wing Likud party. It took place at the very time that an Italian MP was complaining that the Northern League's official website carried vicious anti-Jewish material and pro-Nazi slogans. The Likud group was led by Eli Cohen, a political counselor to former Israeli Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu. Cohen declared that his party preferred Fini to the left, who support the Palestinians. But there may be more than politics at play, as Berlusconi and Netanyahu appear to share an interest in spreading Berlusconi's business empire even wider. Fini's attempts to secure an invitation to visit Israel were denounced by Israel's foreign minister, Yossi Bailon, who was said to be furious over the links between Italy's fascists and the Israeli far right. Haider has been busy building his own part of the Axis through a gathering earlier this year in Klagenfurt, Austria. Invitations to the Festival of Friends were addressed to the far right in Germany, Italy, and Slovenia. The Italian delegation was headed by a notorious old fascist, Paolo Ciani, C-I-A-N-I. Adriano Tilger's Forza Nazionale, also part of Berlusconi's political formation, held its own summer bean fest. The main guest speaker turned out to be a founding member of the Red Army faction, the German 1970s terror group. One fascist group that remains outside Berlusconi's Pole of Liberty is Roberto Fiori's Forza Nuova. Trieste, an Italian enclave bordering Slovenia, has become a prime stronghold of the group. Fiori has addressed the German National Democratic Party, or NPD, in recent months, as has Derek Holland, the mad monk of the International Third Position. The party is facing a possible ban in Germany next month, following the ban on Blood and Honor's German section, with which the NPD has close ties. This fear may be behind rumors that the NPD has shifted key personnel and assets to Trieste, which is set to become a crossroads for Haider, the Italian far right, German Nazi exiles, and Slovenians who appear to supply a lot of the illegal firepower to Europe's extreme right. And in a sidebar to this article, we read, Italy has been rocked by disclosures arising from a commission of inquiry into the role of the state and outside influences during some of the darkest days of the country's post-war history, when bombings, killings, and frame-ups were regular occurrences. Matters that many thought were leftist fantasies have turned out to be true, Jerry Gable writes. Important evidence has emerged from Gianadilio Maletti, who left Italy in a hurry after the failed coup attempt by the fascist Prince Borghese, and has since then lived in exile in South Africa. In an interview with the Italian newspaper La Repubblica, he states firmly that the CIA was behind many of the terrorist attacks of the 1970s, and that NATO not only was involved with Gladio, the stay-behind operation, but was also linked with the acts of terror. He also put the fascist leader Pino Rauti, R-A-U-T-I, who has now returned to mainstream Italian politics, right back in the frame. Government ministers who succeeded in getting some state files opened after 1997 are demanding that all the Secret Service files from the 1940s onwards be made public. Many expect that these will reveal dirty dealing even before the final shots of the Second World War were fired. So again, just as we began this program, number 252, by taking a look at some of the sowing of the seeds in the immediate post-World War II period in which fascist and Nazi elements were recruited to use against the communists, so too we end this last article in the second side with yet another reference to the sowing of those seeds. Note here also the important role of former Ambassador Maxwell Rab, an old friend of the Italian right, with regard to the concretization of Italian far-right and fascist elements taking place in Italy right now. And as noted here in this particular, in the fourth paragraph of this article that I just concluded reading, well, as well, speaking of the Pole of Liberty, Silvio Berlusconi's coalition, but as well as courting Catholics, the Pole of Liberty is also trying to win friends among right-wing Jews in Israel and New York. The Jewish community in Rome and the new and growing community in Trieste, recently enlarged by Jews leaving Carinthia, the Austrian province under Haider's political control, now fear they may be endangered and isolated by those Israelis who share many of Berlusconi's and Fini's political views. Rab is the key player in these dirty political dealings. So again, note the echoes of some of the networking that was done between elements in the West and fascist and communist elements in the immediate post-World War II period. Do not forget that the Soviets were also working with some of these same elements, but that what I call the Underground Reich was working in reality neither for the Soviets, who are now gone, nor for us, but they were working for themselves and pointing toward a post-war revival of fascism. That again from For the Record program number 252. So again, note that in 2000, we have the American right wing in contact with the Israeli right wing through former U.S. Ambassador to Italy Maxwell Rab, and in touch with the right wing through residual Italian fascist elements, including former P2 member Silvio Berlusconi. By the way, Maxwell Rab was killed in a fall on the way to work in June of 2002. So as the peace talks were taking place in the summer of 2000, the Republican right and the elements of the intelligence community, the petroleum industry in Saudi Arabia, that a very important axis, are in touch with and controlling, to a certain extent, the PLO. At the same time, the Republicans, who had been actively subverting Clinton's policy toward the Middle East, are also in touch with the Israeli right. What I suspect happened was that both sides, both the PLO and the Israeli right wing, were told that they would get a better deal with the current administration. And I would note that this administration has backed the Israeli right wing very fully. I suspect that the PLO may feel somewhat double-crossed at this point, but I suspect that double-cross was part of the way these peace talks were sabotaged. One of the things I noted in For the Record 334, among other programs, was that the New York Times of actually July 26th of 2000 had the following two articles as the lead stories. The lead story for the New York Times on July 26th of 2000, Clinton ends deadlocked peace talks, by Jane Perlez. And then, on the other side, the number two story was Bush names Cheney, citing integrity and experience, by Frank Bruni, B-R-U-N-I. Again, those were the two lead stories in the New York Times on July 26th of 2000. I misstated the date. What I suspect happened was that the talks were deliberately torpedoed in order to see to it that the Democrats would not be able to utilize a successful brokering of the peace process as a campaign tool, and would have made a very profound campaign tool. The subsequent reigniting of the Israeli-Palestinian conflagration has basically served as one of the pretexts for the events in and around September 11th. But bearing in mind the fact that the Republicans and the right wing in this country were in touch with the Israeli right, and also through also with the Palestinians, bearing in mind the alleged Palestinian approach during the October surprise back in 1980, I think the evolution of these events may very well have resulted in the deliberate scotching of the peace talks of 2000, and it is that subversion that I have termed the July surprise. This concludes For the Record program number 449, the July surprise, being recorded on March 7th of 2004. My name is Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.